About a guy, everyone. This is Professor Amon-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach. We want to welcome you, along with my co-host, Brother Joe Hembrick, a longtime educator for the Linwood Unified School District and Compton Unified School District as teacher, administrator, first black head coach for Linwood varsity football team, and he commissioned the first Unity Mule at Centennial High School, showing black and browns working together. Joe Hembrick is a longtime historian where he deals with Mott and deals with our ancient history. And we want to welcome again each and every one of you here. We have a very distinguished guest, Dr. Muhammad Ali, I mean, Ali Muhammad, who is the leader of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party. I think they're based in Chicago. I'm not sure. He'll tell you more about that. I didn't get his bio, but I understand he's a medical doctor as well as a psychologist, and he's basing this focus of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party on the '60s Black Panther Party, and he wants to tell us all about it, how and what their movement is about, and then we will ask some questions. Dr. Ali, is it Ali or Dr. Muhammad?
This is Dr. Ali Muhammad. You can just call me Dr. Muhammad.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Ali Muhammad. Okay. Go ahead, Dr. Ali Muhammad. You can tell us more about yourself and then get into your organization.
Absolutely, absolutely. So for those of you who are aware of the Revolutionary Black Panther Party, we are in essence the same of the 60 and that line of dynamic, the party line, just updated today to deal with today's struggle. We have over 40 chapters throughout the US and 15 international chapters. We are located throughout the country. I just happen to be in Chicago at this day and time, but usually I'm in some part of the South, but there is serious work to be done throughout. So that is as far as locale. So we are in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We are in Newark, New Jersey. We're in Camden, New Jersey. We are in Brooklyn and Bronx. I mean, throughout the Northeast and throughout the country, we are located. As far as our ideology, philosophy, and platform, we still stand on the same 10 points. But in essence, we also have aspects of modernity, meaning that we have what I coined and developed as we stand on low-end collectivism and high-end black collectivism. And what that is, the low-end is our overall mission, ideology, and philosophy today, which is to serve, to feed, clothe, shelter, train, and defend the people, also known as the five principles of life within the party. Feed, clothe, shelter, train, and defend. And that's so that we could bring into existence a higher end of that, which is the people self-sufficient with unlimited resources, feeding, clothing, sheltering, training, and indeed defending selves. As far as my background and personal background, both of my parents actually was active in the party throughout the 60s and the 70s, and they raised us on those principles. Your mother says cubs. And it really has an impact on you when you're raised like that, As far as my other background, I graduated at the age of 14. My college education was done in Libya. And yeah, my background is in medicine. I have medical degree in neurology and internal medicine, but I work today as a psychologist. I specialize in trauma and PTSD. With a background in child psychology. From that, I did go to family, also relationship slash family slash marriage. And with that, I had a great opportunity with studies in men and women's psychology because you can't really understand relationships unless you really understand, the dynamics of the male and female social and psychological and behavioral dynamics. And today, trauma, PTSD, but I also specialize in dealing with insomnia, addiction, ADHD, and BPD. And so that's a little bit about my personal background. Also, as far as help put it like this, one issue we have dealing with psychology is it's unfortunate that when it comes to mental health, which is a serious thing for us, too often, we're overlooked to the extent that when we go to seek help, there's bias and racism involved. For example, it's statistically documented that when black men
You in class?
actually
No, my chief
seek
is doing a Zoom. I just wanted to click on to show up that I was there.
when black males, black men go out
My
and
chief, I'm a cadet general at a Revolutionary Black Panther Party.
Cadet Akasha, can you mute your background for a moment? I'm sorry, because I it kind of we can hear it.
I did it for that's why I did it. You can continue.
Okay, very good. So what I was saying is that there's an issue that when black men actually go to get help mentally, there's bias and there's racism involved in that as well. You have black men who statistically, just have anxiety, related issues, depression, sometimes even issues that are just in particular PTSD, and they are misdiagnosed, and it just seems intentionally as having actually being paranoid schizophrenic, and that's an issue, a dilemma at hand as well, and. So the major problem, the major issue at hand is the fact that we as a people and as a collective, when it comes to mental health, as a people who've experienced so much trauma in our Holocaust, that it's very important that we have people who have that understanding. So I say that to say that I also operate, which is known as the Institute of African-Centered Psychology. Basically, which is to help black psychologists and people who are geared towards sociology and the social sciences and even social work to at least have a perspective that deals with us from an empirical standpoint and position. Another dynamic is only roughly 2% of psychologists and psychiatrists are black, and unfortunately, only 4% of social workers are. And so, it's very important that we understand that, because we have so many different issues that is related to psychological, sociological, and behavioral, all surrounding the same basis, that if we don't have the proper actual help, we fall apart. And unfortunately, a major part of our Holocaust has to do with what has happened to us mentally. And so as far as, again, me personally, so that's a, I guess, a decent summary of my background. As far as, wait, can you all hear me? Okay,
Yes.
yeah. So, and as far as some of the work that, we do in the park, we have, programs throughout the country, some of which are, domestic violence preventions, couples counseling, drug treatment, drug prevention, drug rehabilitation, and fully operational chapters. Prenatal, postnatal care, we have 7-day-week food programs that we offer, that is Sunday through Saturday, breakfast through dinner, for children and for youth. We have that starting at 7:30, ending at 9:30, for everyone else, 9:30, approaching noon. Lunch 12:30, 2:30 p.m. Dinner, early dinner 4:30, 7:30 p.m. And late, we have it at 7:30, ending around 10 p.m. And that's 7 day a week at fully operational chapters. We have job placement, job training, economic literacy, as well as we have academic literacy and comprehension that we offer to the community. Some of the job placement involves certifications to CDL, CNA. And we also have reacclimation programs for people who, are freshly released, from just using a use of lesser terms, incarceration. So we have it's a lot of very good things that we do. We also have what I coin as the human rights movement and Freedom Rides. And what this is this, traditionally, whenever we had issues, we would sojourn, and I'm just speaking of like the 60s and 70s and our, more or less the 50s and 60s, I mean, in our heyday of this, what we call the civil rights movement. Then, traditionally when we went out, marching and protesting, we didn't really come out armed. That whole popularity, even though we know that Robert F. Williams, existed with Negroes with guns, we knew of the Deacons of Defense. Most, really don't know that popularity until we rose up in the party, we rose up armed. But the point is that for the most part of our actual rights movement, we were unarmed. We were unarmed. We got, beat with nightsticks and had water holes sprayed upon us, spraying the hair off the scalps of some of our babies. It was that powerful rip that could rip the bark off a tree. Dogs, sicked on us. So the point of having the armed movement is that when we do actions that are geared towards our human rights, which can involve even, I mean, it may sound contradictory, but it's not some type of level of passive resistance. At least there are people there who are armed, where if rights were violated, they can be self-defense, meaning that, of course, there's aspects of passive resistance that can get a person incarcerated. At the same time, if something like that would happen, that doesn't mean a person needs to get abused, needs to get dragged on the ground, or any of those foolish things. There's a level of civility that still comes with that. But not to digress. In essence, with that, we also do tribunals where people's tribunals, where we gather up the atrocities that have happened, whether it's genocide or aspects of ethnic cleansing. Because too often, what happens is that we're so stuck into the assimilated so-called norms and status quo of the system, even sometimes when we're striving to be revolutionary conscious or Black conscious or Pan-African or the different dynamics that we are, a lot of times we stay stuck and subordinated in this box of assimilation, and we don't know that we are. And our outlook and outlets are that. And what I'm saying, what I'm actually saying by saying that is this: some of us feel, or we only know that, let's say, for instance, the police, the pigs gun down a young brother or sister, or could be anybody in our communities. We take them to the court if it gets that far. Sometimes the court, will not charge them. Then we take it to the Supreme Court and we deal with it with civil rights. And a lot of times, nothing comes out of that. And one good form of confusion we have when fighting for our rights is that our rights is bigger than civil rights. We're human. So our issue is also a matter of human rights. And when you deal with human rights, there's international law. So when we do our tribunals, this is along the lines of what that is. So it's people tribunals where we deal with the issue according to international law. That, okay, this police officer shot this running person. What is that considered? Well, when you deal with an armed person who's an operative of a government or an agent of a government, which a law enforcement officer is, one way or another, whether that is locally, whether it's statewide, or whether it's, some type of federal dynamic or whatever it is that they're doing, the point is that this is an armed person within government and this is a civilian. In any other country, when a person has arms and they're committing crimes against civilians, this is considered a war crime. This is also considered so many different dynamics of a crime against humanity, meaning that according to the Geneva Convention, a soldier can't shoot a fleeing person, can't shoot a fleeing combatant, enemy combatant, and definitely can't shoot a civilian, armed or unarmed. But they do that to us all the time, and nobody talks about it. We have a court case. They may get charged with murder, manslaughter, second degree murder, but these issues and topics never come up. And the reason why it never comes up is because the politics of what it is. We're not aware of what these things are, and we keep it locked in the U.S. paradigm. But these are really human rights issues. A police officer shooting you down. It's not just, so-called police brutality. That's not even considered some type of law where the law is this is called police brutality. That's just a actual term we use. But in essence, according to international law, that is actually a crime against humanity, and it's a war crime. If you tear gas at at protesters, tear gas at people who are doing a rally, tear gas at marchers. You can't do that. You cannot do that even during war. If there's protesters, it's a violation of the Geneva Convention to have tear gas or rubber bullets, but they do that to us, which, you know, we have to really, you know, think about how deep this is. But not to digress, the point of having the tribunals is to deal with the human rights violations of whatever it is that we're going through. And it ain't just the law enforcement police situation. It's our pig situation. It's also the other things, you know, poverty, unemployment, poor housing, how these utility companies exploit us. Because according to international law, water is not a choice. Also now electricity is not a choice. These are actual human rights, because you can't survive without water. You can't survive without electricity. So they're not even supposed to charge you for that. Even housing is a human right. And I don't mean some subsidies or some HUD or anything like that, but these are human rights. But not to digress and get off point and off task and off topic, just, you know, basically expressing some dynamics of, you know, what we are, who we are, what we stand on, and what those things are, and where we are today, and some of my background for those who are unaware.
Professor Rod, you're muted.
Okay, yeah, I appreciate what you said, Father St. Croix. We're going to see if anybody around the panel have any questions. Brother Mashinda, you want to start? Any questions?
No, I don't have any questions right now.
All right, then, Brother Hembrick?
Yes, sir. Evening, Dr. Muhammad. My question is, you mentioned that you guys function on an international level also. But my question is there any kind of chapter in the southern part of India where the Untouchables live? And if so, what's going on there with the Dalits?
That's a very great question. We don't actually have a chapter in India. However, our international headquarters is in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. That is actually headed by General Makeda. That's the general that we have there in Ethiopia. When we use the term general, that's our equivalent today of a chairman or chairwoman or chairperson. Those are the terms that we use. But in essence, as far as that is concerned, you know, there is genocide and ethnic cleansing and, you know, what's the best way to say this? Discrimination, you know, throughout, unfortunately, throughout Asia, you know, and throughout India. But we don't directly have any particular type of chapter there. But any issues that that do exist, you know, any chapter that we have anywhere in the Middle East and Asia or on the continent definitely would have relevance and direct responsibility to aid and assist. You know, we haven't gotten any direct complaints from that area, but, you know, like I was going to say, throughout the world, there's so many different atrocities that go on in Asia and India and the so-called Middle East and even on the continent of Africa that, you know, we would have to have a whole segment to deal with, you know, just the level, especially the ethnic cleansing and the, you know, because most of the dynamic is that's really what goes on in those areas. We know that the indigenous population of that area, you know, are melanated people, as we can just be free here and use the term black people. We know that the so-called caste system in India was never a light skin versus dark skin thing. It was racism and white supremacy that made it that way. Like, for example, when it came to the caste system, you know, you got to get into now, if we're talking about India, one thing that I don't do is I don't mix politics or revolution with religion or spirituality, but I'm going to put it together because in this context, it does exist. And we also know that in Pan-Africanism, you know, we're open to both. But the point is that and talking about that, when you approach that particular part of the world, you get into, you know, the Brahmin, you get into, you know, the whole dynamic of what things represent. Well, the Arya dynamic or that part of the cast. It was never a color thing. It was more about, a who you were type thing. Like, for example, Krishna, or Sri Krishna. Krishna means, don't just mean black, it means blue black. But, Krishna will more or less in that connection be on the higher scale of things, right? And then we got people like, Satya Sai Baba, rest in peace. We have Sai Baba Shirdi, and these were very dark skinned people with woolly hair. Satya Sai Baba, dark, but Sai Baba Shirdi was chocolate black, and he's a high caste person. That chocolate black, look like, as a matter of fact, anybody familiar with the Rastafari culture and the Boba Shanti culture, who became King Emmanuel, Prince Emmanuel, they kind of look something alike, actually, the two of them. But my point is that, so with that dynamic, it was never so much about a pale white skin versus a dark skin or brown, red, or yellow. It was always about social class and ethnic dynamics, not so much racial. It's just like, for example, what was contrived by the in Rwanda, for example, basically how when the colonizers begin to, leave Rwanda, they in essence, turned us on each other, where you had the Tutsi and you had the Hutu. And in essence, in dealing with that, with the Tutsi and the Hutu, you got people who, for the most part, have the same exact history, have the same exact, everything, but a class and ethnic and a forced ethnicity was created. The Belgium is what I want to say. When the Belgium left, the Belgium created a hierarchy. So what they would do is they would take certain people of the same original nation state or tribal or ethnic background, and they created a division. They called the Tutsis the people that had like longer limbs and like smaller noses and things like that. They'll try to say that that was a Tutsi, and the Hutu were people who had broader lips and coarser hair. But then, because we're the same people, we get those varieties regardless of who it is and who isn't what. But my point of saying that is saying this to you. That was one of the most modern day, larger scales of ethnic supremacy and ethnic genocide on the continent of Africa amongst African people, what happened in Rwanda. So I'm just using that as an example of when we start talking about the Dalits and the Tamil, and when we start talking about Dalits and Tamil, heck, Kamala Harris's mother is Tamil, and that's why when you see her, you don't see what we think is the stereotypical, Indian person. When we see her mother, she just looked like what we call in our culture, a yellow bone, right? And she don't look like those other people. That's because the Tamil, the Dalits, and the Sudra people, tend to look like, other melanated people, even within the continent of Africa. And we study some histories, we know that the Indus Valley civilization, and some of our histories, okay, it's considered an extension of, ancient Abyssinia or ancient Ethiopia, or ancient Kush in some of our histories. At least some of our histories say that, right? But not to digress and get off your question, we don't directly have a chapter there, but any atrocities or problems that exist, we're always available to help people, oppressed people, regardless of where they are.
Well, they have a Black Panther organization there. That's why I asked the question.
Yeah. And Palestine too. I'm familiar with both.
Okay. Appreciate it.
All right.
You're very welcome.
Brother Mansour, Masous, is that Masous?
Masood?
Yeah. You have any questions?
Well, goodness gracious. Thanks for calling me in and seeing if I have something to say. A lot of this is quite interesting for me. I have some familiarity with some of the things, but I am definitely learning some new stuff. I think the one thing that stands out in my mind, the brother talked about agents armed agents, for instance, here in America, whether the local or state or national level, who are armed. And and then they, their behavior is toward us in a very unfair, whether they shoot us or beat us or whatever it might be. Well, not just us, but anybody who goes against whatever the dominant society is at that moment. The idea that those kind of behaviors on the part of those people are crimes and that they can be tried for them, does that mean that you would need, if I'm a victim of that, I would need a lawyer that would represent me in that kind of a setting, that kind of a trial? And then, given that at least I've never seen that happen, where a person, takes the government to task for that sort of thing in that kind of arena, are there even lawyers who are strong enough or feel that they want to mess with that kind of case? Would it be profitable for them or not? So I just wonder, is that the kind of a situation where you need representation, but no lawyer in their right mind in America is going to take a case like that? Am I sort of, I hope I didn't convolute that, but I hope you can sort of understand what I'm trying to ask.
You are 100% clear on your question because I understand it 100%, and I appreciate the question. And so, in asking that question and answering that question, here's the dynamic, and it's a very powerful, meaningful, and pertinent question. And I feel it's one that should be asked because, I mentioned something, and it definitely needs to be asked because, yeah, how does that even work, right? So I like to give some background and history on it. So here's the thing, one of the great things that Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Baba Mwali, Malcolm X, rest in peace, rest in power, gave us, besides taking us to the level that we ended up in, well, he's the one who taught us, then he said, we keep talking about civil rights, he says, your issue is not civil rights. That's a domestic thing here in the United States. I'm paraphrasing him now. He said that our issue was human rights, that
Yes.
the US courts were not qualified. He said, don't bring no cracker in Georgia for your atrocities. The government is responsible. So he explained to us that our issue wasn't this domestic thing, that it's not this civil thing that we keep locking ourselves in this paradigm. He said it was actual thing that the world court needed to intervene and get involved in. That's what he expressed to us. When he started talking like that and moving like that and putting things together like that, this is he ultimately was assassinated, on that threshold. Something like Dr. King, when Dr. King starts saying that it's bigger than just integrating lunch counters and stuff like that, and now it's really economic injustice and it's, the new phase of the rights movement and how this was becoming this thing of broader issues of human rights, they took him out too before he could even go to DC and do that. But my point to directly answer that is this. So, when Malcolm talked about it, he was taken out, and no one has ever been able to. No one really gets on that mantle. I would say that some of my direct elders, Gaddy Obadiah and Mary Obadiah, I say direct coming from the Provisional Government Republic of New Africa. I am the first vice president of the Provisional Government Republic of New Africa, and I am the People's Central Council chairman. So coming out of those traditions, Gaddy and Mary Obadiah were students of Malcolm X, coming from the Malcolm X Society. And also, as far as the signing of our declaration that formatted the Republic of New Africa, Betty Shabazz was the first vice president at that time, and Robert Williams was the president, in exile. But getting back, not to digress, but my point is this: no one really ever really got on that topic. I would say that Obadali did, speak about the fact of, how. What paradigm and direction we needed to go, and even talked about reparations in that way. And that's where COBRA came from, out of that. And COBRA, is basically came from the government. The government made it, made in COBRA, which is an organization, but the point, the reparations organization, we're getting back to the point. So, in answering that question, so it had never been, broad the way Malcolm spoke about. So, around 2014, going into 2015, I went over to The Hague and we presented some things. I'm saying myself now, with the Revolutionary Panther Party at that time, and submitted some briefs, dealing with the U.S. government and genocide for black people, and they accepted those briefs. So for years, when I do these human rights tribunals and I do these actual armed marches, some people who don't understand, they think that, oh, the march is just like, you know, some type of antagonization. I mean, an antagonization. The marches are just to show strength, but the real reality is these tribunals. So as far as that is concerned, it's not so much where we'll be dealing with lawyers in the U.S. Paradigm, because a lot of lawyers don't know international law. Even the best constitutional lawyers don't know international law. So it takes international, you know, law versus lawyers, but also those bodies and structures, the World Court and ICC, International Criminal Court, all of that, they have access to lawyers that can assist and to help. And after George Floyd, they had a delegation of lawyers that were connected to the World Court and ICC that actually themselves surmised a conclusion on what's going on with black people in America as a form of genocide, especially related to this police, you know, assault and terror that we're dealing with. And so there is a structure and body in the international community that's structured for that. And how one would go about that is, I would say right now, I don't know too many people that are involved doing it. I do know that Baba Shukwe Lumumba, rest in peace, rest in power, and the Malcolm X grassroots movement at some point in level did some studies, but I don't know of anybody who actually is. Why, no, I'm gonna just say this, and maybe if it is, they can forgive me for that. I don't know nobody that's doing tribunals. So I would say if you have those issues, reach out to us, reach out to me, submit whatever situation you have with law enforcement, and we will come and do a tribunal and submit that overseas, submit that to the proper bodies, to the World Court and ICC, where it needs to be submitted to. And ultimately, when there can be some drawn conclusion to this, we can have a very vast actual international trial against this government because it's needed. But like I said, those briefs were submitted and accepted to cite genocide against the U.S. government. We know that Trump, none of them are off the hook. Obama, none of them are off the hook. Biden, none of them are off the hook, whether Republican or Democrat, it makes no difference. When it comes to dealing with the only person, and he's not the best of people either. You know, he's responsible for the Omnibus Crime Bill and the new Jim Crow. Clinton was the only one that came close to actually fully accepting the ICC. He accepted it. He just didn't get an opportunity to ratify it, but he was doing it. What's my point in saying this is that America's made it their duty to distance themselves from the World Court and from the different courts that deals with genocide and crimes against humanity, because they know how deep their atrocities are against us and others. And so they've tried to distance themselves. And so there's a status that you're supposed to have to be able to be tried in certain courts like that. But my point, not to digress, is that they made it clear in these courts that it doesn't matter if that nation state has accept, you know, a connection to them or not. That if there is genocide, ethnic cleansing, or war crimes that exist, they're still going to produce the warrants. They're still going to produce the actions. Now, I remember I was on a, either it was a panel, or it was a podcast or broadcast. It was about a year ago, and somebody was. It was about Israel and Gaza, and they were like, you know, well, they were upset with the fact that though, you know, it was agreed upon that it was genocide going on in Gaza and this legal stuff happened, but there was no force behind it. Here's what people don't understand. Okay. When you deal with the United Nations, that's exactly what it's called, the United Nations, right? And that means the nations, the countries of the world united, right? So we have to think of it like the Senate and the Congress, right? And the US. I'm just giving it that kind of paradigm to give us an example of what it is. So these nations are like the Senate and the Congress. It's up to the people to present what the issues are, either of those nations and countries, or their bodies and structures, just like the Senate or Congress. What I'm saying is this. So if the issues are brought up that this is an egregious things are happening, genocide is happening right here, and that's brought up amongst that body and structure, then it becomes the matter at hand. The problem is that we don't understand that level of international politics to really understand what's going on. So our issues are never brought up there because we're not bringing it up. There's other stuff brought there, like, you know, population stabilization, World health and starvation. But our issue of genocide isn't brought there. But if it was brought there, then that it's immediate action. And this is why Malcolm was, in my opinion, why Malcolm was assassinated, because it was the point of bringing it there. But I'm just saying that work is now in effect because, I have gone over to The Hague. We have brought things forward. The point is that when we reach this collective consensus with all of our people, and that's the problem at hand, because I know that me speaking about this, none of us have never, well, I was on before, but I'm saying we haven't been in any type of longevity of conversing. When this type of work is done, they try to keep it isolated on the corner, on the side somewhere. But if you look up anything about me and the Revolutionary Panther Party, you'll see Arm March here, you will see tribunals here. I'm saying when you look it up, but it's nothing that's broadened where people really understand what that is, because they don't want nobody to understand. But that is the purpose. So when I go out here and do this political work like that, these armed marches and tribunals, that's exactly what it's for. Genocide against this government, and ethnic and basically for them committing acts of ethnic cleansing against us. That's really when it comes to the politics, that's really the hard politics that we stand on. Even with dealing with this current issue I'm dealing with right now in Flint, Michigan, with the murder of 17-year-old Rayvon Shaheed. As a matter of fact, I'm going back there this week, Friday, and to give some clarity on what that is and what that's all about real quickly. So Rayvon Shaheed, November 2nd, 2024. Young black boy, Flint, Michigan, just walking down the street minding his business. The pigs harassed him. They chased him down like an animal, and ultimately led to them shooting him 6 times. One going over him, shooting him 6 times in his back and 1 time in the back of his head. Murdered him. Murdered this boy. And this is just how things were at that time. He's murdered, and nobody wanted to do anything about it. So, ultimately, with me getting involved, on behalf of the family and everything like that, there were demands that we had. Number one, the first demand was, arresting those officers and charging them for them to do that. The second was to release their names to the public. The third was the defunding of the state police that they worked for, these troopers, with the Michigan State Police. The fourth was the release of the full footage. The fourth was charging them with witness tampering and things of that nature, because that was also alleged that they did that. Went to where the recordings were, people's houses and phones, and did all kind of stuff to try to erase evidence. But what ultimately happened that once we gave the demands, we gave them these demands on February 1st of 2025, and they did some little, gave them 30 days. That would be March 1st. And so within about 6 days, the AG, Attorney General, Dana Neely, hope I'm not badgering the name, but anyways, the Michigan State Attorney General, she responds, and her response is that she wasn't going to charge them, just paraphrasing what she said, because it was like she feel it was self-defense and she wasn't charging them and all of that. That was her opinion, right? That she went through the whole process, of what happened, and when we get the report, the one officer trooper talks about he shot Rayvon when he was running, because it's more than just the 6 shots to the back and one in the back of the head. It was also 2 shots in the leg where he fell. So he was already on the ground. So there was no first, there was no reason to shoot him, period. But the other stuff, was just like it was already horrible, but it was even worse at that point, right? But here's the point. He said that, he had been, in the community before, and somebody was running and shot at him. So, he had that kind of problem going on. My whole point of that is, if you have that level of PTSD, and I'm gonna say this as a professional, or that level of like trauma, you don't you that's a hostile work environment then. Meaning that any environment that can trigger you to respond in such a way, you need to be at a desk somewhere or doing another job. You don't need to be on the streets. With people, if somebody running is going to trigger you to kill somebody, that means if a little baby's running, you kill a baby too. So that doesn't make any sense. And technically, that is a baby, a 17-year-old, but not to digress and get long-winded. So she said those things. What she did do is she did release some of the footage. She did release their names to the public. But the things we asked for didn't happen. And so I came back there March 1st. I had a tribunal on February 1st, is my point, the Human Rights Tribunal. for Flint, Michigan, and that particular issue was top of it, including the unemployment, including the current crime rate. All that stuff was put in the tribunal. My point is this. So March the 1st, it came back in reference to the 30 days and what we would give them. So we gave them an additional 12 days to meet to rectify what they didn't do. And this week will make that Thursday would make the 12th day. And we told them that by Friday, March the 14th, that there'll be actions, towards making sure that they were charged and arrested. I'm not fully going to say what those actions are because it's like, I'm going to say it's internal and it's for a matter of internal security on how we're going to handle that. But everybody will know by Friday how we did handle it. So that's, I just say that for now, right? And for any of the enemies that's listening or that will be listening, we're not talking about nothing crazy or nothing that you could try to tie us into to say we did some type of because we're anti-terrorist, anti-extremist, but we will be doing action that we have legal rights to do to make sure that we get these creeps off the streets. So that matter at hand again was a human rights. We did a tribunal, and that's what the whole armed dynamic was. But you have. Go ahead, I'm listening.
Yeah, I just briefly because I don't want to take a lot of time either, but everything you've described, I totally understand it and I can follow it all. I wouldn't dare try to regurgitate everything you said, but I understand what you're saying.
Yes.
So that just leads me to a sort of final conclusion relative to how America dominates the planet militarily and economically. That's a lot of power in the hands of one country, regardless of how many other countries are on the planet. America is dominant. Hence, this kind of international justice is trying to achieve it is, I'll just say, fleeting because America has so much dominance, so much influence. I just imagine they can do what they want, exert pressure wherever they want to ensure that none of that kind of justice ever comes here. I shouldn't say it like that it would never happen, but the likelihood, because of the military and economic dominance of America, America can just kind of like brush it under the rug. Is that a fair assessment?
That is
But that's
100%.
why they have
organizations like this to do it themselves. That's why
Sure.
they have their own tribunal, and it's up to the people to rise up. But you raise a good question about America veto power in the international courts, and they never signed the International Human Rights Declaration in 1948. They didn't sign until almost 1986. They didn't want to become a part of the Declaration of Human Rights because of their atrocities and
Right,
the
right.
genocide. But that's why wherever there's injustice, there's going to be people to stand up. And they may not have the power to hold people to court in America's trumped-up courts and corrupt courts and things in this nation, but they still find ways to get justice, such as with George Floyd. It took people to burn down the whole city to get them to take them police to court. Same thing
Right.
with Michael Brown I forget what the
Ohio.
no, he wasn't in. Michael Brown was in
He was in Missouri. Right.
Ferguson, and
Missouri,
they burned
Missouri.
that down. Same thing with Watts, with Ted Wilder, and with the Frye brothers, the Watts Rebellion, L.A. Night, and the boy that they beat in '92. People rise up sometimes, and take out their own justice. That's the
Okay.
way that go. But going back,
Okay.
McBride, Ernest, you have any questions? Because we had a, they had a Panther Party in Long Beach at one time with Brother Woodrow and Brother Sonny Pittsnam,
Oh yeah, they had
and
the little YAM movement, youth action movement going, yeah. So, and they I don't know, 'cause somebody told me that oh, like Brother Muhammad, they got a organization. I mean, a Black Panthers is there one here locally in the LA area?
Dr. Ali?
I was on mute. Yeah, we have a local chapter there in LA. We do. We do.
Yeah, I just wondered because I know back in the when Sonny and them was going Pitts now, that was kind of back in the 60s too, when they had here in Long Beach. So,
yes.
Kind of at that time, I was kind of out of the loop because I was married, went in the service, got drafted, and then got out of that and then was working for the shipyard. So, I wasn't really in the loop of doing much, only the little local protests we did with my dad, you know, with NAACP trying to integrate the police department, fire department, and city jobs. So we were kind of.
Oh, that's good. Sister.
Doing that.
Sister Keisha? Is that Acacia Zaya?
Sister Akasha.
Sister Akasha?
Asha. It's Akasha.
Do you have any questions or compliments or comments?
No, I was just soaking up the knowledge and learning.
Okay. Sister Linda, you still there? Out of Florida?
Yes, I'm here. I'm soaking up the knowledge, she said. No, I don't have any questions right now.
Okay, then. Brother Rashiki Maskani?
Yes, I just wanted to know, do you guys have any affiliation or connections with any of the other major Black organizations throughout the country, like the NAACP, the Nation of Islam? Do you have any affiliation?
Definitely. When it comes to Black organizations and Black groups, I mean, we have worked with, you know, how would I say, a great majority of them, including NAACP. Most of that have been on local levels, though. Of course, Black Lives Matter too. We have worked with them. As a matter of fact, in Flint, with this particular thing we're dealing with, their local Flint chapter works with us in dealing with this particular issue. CORE, Urban League, you know, different groups that are traditionally connected, especially the Nation, you know. I've had a working relationship with them for a long time. You know, I'm going to say, when I say active working relationship, for over 20 years with the Nation, active working, meaning that as an adult and being active, you know. I say that because, you know, there was a time because of aspects of my background that, you know, I was once a processing member, you know, and had an early dynamic with them, you know, before I was an adult with the Nation, you know, junior FOI kind of dynamic. So, but as far as, you know, political and work, you know, work relationship with them, Miami, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, throughout the country, you know, even out of Chicago, also Missouri, yeah, throughout the country, and also at one point in time in LA as well, you know. So, yeah, definitely a worker relationship, you know, and also open, though, even if there is no active worker relationship, we're open to work with any Black group and any Black organization, you know, as long as their focus is, you know, for the betterment of Black people. We're open to working with them, you know, regardless of, you know, of, you know, we don't hold no, we understand that unity is key. And we also understand that we can't be elitist in anything that it is that we're doing. So, yeah, we're open to work with anybody, regardless of, as long as their focus is for the betterment of the people.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Professor Ra, Brother Muko didn't get called on.
Okay, well, we just called on it.
All right, Brother Muko.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation, Brother Muhammad. I'm glad to hear that you deal in matters of mental health I myself suffer from PTSD. And I want to ask a couple of questions, and I don't want to be too long-winded because I know you have been detailed. I want to ask you, do you or your organization have a crystal clear compensatory meaning for racism, white supremacy? I heard you say it in that complete term one time, and I was just wondering, and I always seem to I always want to ask, especially when I'm talking to fellow victims of racism, white supremacy, if they have a meaning of racism, white supremacy, especially if they're representing the organization, if your organization has a complete meaning of racism, white supremacy that you can explain in probably less than a minute and it makes sense. And does your organization particularly have any sectors in it that teach maybe the youth or people in the organization what racism, white supremacy is and how it works? And my third question is, are you familiar with Francis Cresswell's work, The Isis Papers? And that's it.
Definitely appreciate your question. The line of your questions are, I heard one and two almost sound like they're the same, and correct me if I'm wrong. The number three definitely is clearly a third, and that is, do we have a definition of what racism or white supremacy is? A clear definition. That was your first question, right?
Right.
Second thing is, was it, do we know what it is? What was the second question?
The second question was, in your organization, do you have a sector in your organization that teaches the youth or the other people in the organization exactly what racism, white supremacy is and that meaning of it, or the organization's meaning of it, if in fact y'all have a meaning for racism, white supremacy?
And the third question was, if I was familiar with Dr. Frances Cresswell.
Yes, her work, The
ISIS
ISIS
papers,
Papers.
right?
Yes,
Okay.
yes, yes.
So I really, to be honest with you, being here is like being, and I'm saying this respectfully, it's like being somewhere that I wrote the questions to ask because I love y'all questions. So let me ask. It almost seemed to me like I wrote them, and I say this respectfully, not condescending. I'm just saying we have that kind of cohesion, and I love the energy and the spirit that we all have. These are very beautiful and powerful questions. So first and foremost, Dr. Nellie Fuller, rest in peace, rest in power, one of the greats amongst us. He was the one who science to us what racism was, that racism is and was and still is, of course, white supremacy, number one. So when it comes to defining racism and white supremacy, even in our orientation, anybody who's taken, that's the first thing we talk about when we get into, we say clearly that it must be understood. Yes, we are socialists. We're scientific socialists. We are that. We are also African-centered Marxist-Leninists. We are that. We hold a party line that way, but we also are Neo-African socialists, and we also are scientific African socialists. And I'll break down what that stuff is if I have some time tonight, but not to digress. But though we're all of that, we still have to understand that there's a war waged against us. We're no volition of our own. The color of our skin is our official uniform. And racism, yes, is white supremacy. How is that defined? As the great Baba, the great elder, Dr. Nellie Fuller gave it to us. That's empirical. That's not a contradiction. That it is a global system that affects politics. It affects economics. It affects education. It affects religion. It affects family. It affects anything that you could name that exists. That's what it does. Now, what is the empirical sociological definition of racism? It is prejudice plus power. Now, that is the sociological definition, and we also stand with that too. But how does that even work? Because some people will say, use the term racism out of context. They'll say, us, if I call a Caucasian person a cracker, or I say I can't stand them, or something to that effect. They'll say, oh, you're a racist. And I'm not saying I do that. I feel that when it comes to that, and I'm going to say this, there are white people who do mean well and can be revolutionary comrades. I don't know who gets offended by me saying it, but it's true. But there are crackers that exist, and a cracker is a racist white person who stands on racism and white supremacy and who actually feels that our life has no value. And there'll always be crackers to me. That's not going to change, right? But here's the point, though. Staying on point and staying on task. Racism being prejudice plus power. It's like sexism is prejudice plus power. What does that mean? Well, a woman can be prejudiced, but we live in a white, male-dominated, sexist, xenophobic, fascist, racist society. So being that it's a patriarchal society, the woman don't have the power to be sexist. She could just be prejudiced. She could just say, I hate all men, but she ain't got the power to do nothing. When it comes to racism, it's the same thing. We live in a white male dominated, white people are the social majority. We're the social subordinate. And social subordinate, social majority don't mean by number. It could have been a billion of us and 2 million of them. You know, just like how in South Africa the dynamics are. It's more African people than there is the white people who call themselves Afrikaners, but the white Afrikaners were the social majority because they were the power structure, right? So here's the point, though. So the point I'm making is that being that it is a white patriarchal society dominated by them, they have the power to exercise their prejudice over housing, over the judicial system, over the legislative system, over the economic system, over the academic system, aka education system, over the family system, over the religion and the spiritual system. And so we can never be that because they got the power. So that's racism. So yeah, the definition of racism is indeed white supremacy. That's exactly what it is. And it's not just in America. It's global, as Dr. Fuller actually scienced it to us. Now, Dr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing, I consider them, there's not too many people I can consider. And I say this respectfully, and I say that because I hold things in a high threshold. Besides my father, Dr. Kwame Ture, rest in peace, rest in power, is one. And I'm going to say for a period of time, Dr. Francis Quest-Wilson and Dr. Nellie Fuller. You know, when I used to come on the campus there at Howard, I can consider them extended mentors of me personally, meaning that what I stand on as a psychologist has a lot to do with the Kress theory. You know, what I stand on and my understanding of racism and white supremacy has, I'm going to say, exclusively a lot to do with them, because my original understandings of it came from studying in their work, studying his, what do you call it? Good, I can't even pronounce the name right now. But Dr. Fuller's code, I'm going to just subordinate that way. Dr. Fuller's code on racism. You know, his book is a big white book, what became a big white book. And basically, you know, he breaks down exactly what racism and white supremacy is. And it definitely, you know, is exact. Oh, the United Independent Compensatory Code and system of was a system of our system. We're dealing with racism and white supremacy. But anyways, getting back to the point. So all of it came from that, you know. And then as a you know, a psychologist, you know, other studies, you know, of course, I have to credit them first, Dr. Nellie Fuller and Dr. Francis Cuss Wilson, and of course the ISIS paper. I read that so many times. That's the first book that I get to my children amongst other books to read, right? But what's the other thing? And Dr. Francis.
I think you answered all three of his questions.
Okay.
Yeah, Muko, you have any other questions? Okay. Appreciate what you said, if I understand correctly. I want to really compliment you on your efforts to lift the consciousness of our people and build a structure, organizations nationwide for the purposes of, you know, people being able to defend themselves and practice a sense of consciousness of genocide and what we can do about it. And that's complimentary. Any effort to bring forth the people to educate themselves, mobilize themselves, organize themselves, and confront the system is very important. But I just have a few questions. I'm Professor Amin Ra, and I've been in the struggle since 1965. And I've worked with many groups, many groups, many leaders. Many of them I'm on a first name basis with. But at the same time, I just want to ask you a few questions. It's not to quiz you or question the authenticity of your effort, but just to get some yes and no questions so that the audience can get a better flavor of
Yes.
what your organization is about. The first thing
Yes,
I want
sir.
to know is how long have y'all been in existence?
Officially since 1992.
Since 1992.
Yeah.
So did you were you ever a part of or worked with the new Black Panther Party with Dr. Khalid Muhammad and Dr. Shabazz, Muhammad Shabazz? Are you familiar with them?
I'm familiar with them, and I'm familiar with other groups that actually, have the name. I know their whole entire history. As far as if I was ever, I was never a member of the New Black Panther Party, but I will say in 20, around 2015, we had a comrade who is Brother Fahim Ali, RBG, rest in peace, rest in power. He was the People's Center Counsel for the Republic of New Africa.
Yeah,
And
I know Imari Opadeli. I worked close with Imari before he passed, and we had him at Cal State Long Beach to speak a couple of times, Republic of New Africa out of Jackson, Mississippi, and he had to form that. I'm familiar with Omari. But the other question I have for you is you say you model yourself after the Panther Party in the 60s. Is that correct?
100%, yes.
Yeah, they had a 10-point program,
Yes.
and that 10-point program is, fair rent, right, fair housing,
Absolutely.
education,
Yes, sir.
breakfast program, this, that, this, that. But they also, at the end, said we have to work within the system, and that's when they began to run for political office. Elder Cleaver ran for president. I think a couple of them ran for local government. Huey was out of town, out the country at the time, and then he came back, but. Are you saying that y'all gonna in the system and run for political offices eventually, or what?
Well, one thing you have that you and you as an elder, Baba, I know you understand that there's a lot of dialectical conversations, debates, and arguments within it, but everybody didn't agree with that about working within this system because one reason was this, especially Baba Huey wrote a lot about that as well. One of the issues and even Eldridge, in the 70s, he was not on that at all. He didn't start doing that till much later. In the 70s, he said there must be a revolution, that he was upset the fact that we had community programs. He said that he believed in revolutionary socialism and we had to destroy the whole country. That's what he
But he
stood on.
ran for president in 68, him and with the Free Peace and Freedom Party at 68, him and sister Angela Davis ran for president.
But yeah,
And
I'm
she
talking
wasn't
about
even a member of the party, but
yeah.
my point is that he did run for president, is that correct?
Right, he did, but I'm talking about the 1970s Eldridge. If you remember what he said that he was no longer concerned with that kind of stuff. It's not even the survival programs. He said that, basically, that there must be a revolutionary overthrow of the system. If you remember, he said that, ultimately Eldridge also was in exile himself when he had to go to Algiers.
Yeah, I remember all that. I remember when he came back and things of this nature, and they had a split in the party. They split, someone with Bobby Seale, someone with Eldridge. But now let me get to another question. The other question is, when you do your psychology, and you say you got your degree in Libya.
My medical degrees, yeah. My psychology degrees is from KwaZulu-Natal, which is in South Africa.
Okay, are you licensed in the United States?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so do you operate out of an office or with an agency?
Prior to COVID, I used to have my own practice, but now I do telehealth.
Because I've done that. I had to operate under somebody else's license when I was doing psychological. As a matter of fact, I did psychological warfare for the nation. But the other point is, did when Khalid, when Rashid Key asked you, did you work with other organizations? You have the National Black United Front, You have not. You have. You did mention in NCORPA, the National Coalition for Reparations. Do you work with? And these are pretty strong organizations. And then we did have armed struggle organizations, the Black Liberation Army. You had the also CENTCU. You had a. We've had armed struggle throughout our history. I mean,
Of course.
Nat Turner was an armed struggle.
Of
You know,
course.
we can go back, but I'm just saying that do y'all train or, I mean, because see, revolution in social services, which most of your programs seem to be, is different from revolution. Is that just the name, Revolutionary Party? But you say y'all do a lot of social work helping people.
So let me answer that and answer that thoroughly and clear. Here's the issue. Revolution, right? So one thing what we teach when we teach about war and warfare in our political education is that war is easy. That part of revolution, killing, murdering, training, all that is easy, but it's the warfare that's the problem. What's the warfare? I need a thirdly answer. So let's say, for example, you got a feud between, and I don't want to use them, but I got to the Bloods and Crips, okay? So you got some Crips that ride on the Bloods and they just murk everybody. They kill or unalive all of them, right? But there's another generation coming up that's gonna fight back, right? So what's the point? The point is that the warfare is longer lasting than just killing and murdering, right? So what's the point I'm saying with saying that? That there's a reason why our mission is to feed. That's our we call it our military mission to feed, clothe, shelter, train, defend. Because what is that? Food. Starving people is a form of war and warfare. Who was it? Nixon. What they call that? That was USM number 200, where they talked about starving the world as a form of warfare. They said bullets have not been successful in the USM number 200. They call it food genocide. That bullets had not been that successful. So what they
They're
had to do.
using that in Gaza. Yeah, they're using that in
Right,
Gaza.
yeah. And so that's a form of warfare. Food is a form of warfare. We said feed, clothe, making sure people are underclad that the elements can destroy them is a form of war and warfare. Food, clothes, shelter, lack of habitation is a form of warfare. Training, not being trained, that could be militarily trained, academically trained, survival training, parental training, and defense. That's the armed part. So, yes, we do training. We have a boot camp that we have. It's called Camp Garvey 3. That's in Jackson, Mississippi, where we have people come out annually. Because of resources as a people, of course, we can't do 90 days like the U.S. military and some militaries do. But we actually have a successful 2 weeks training where we go over, and I can say this publicly, certain battle drills, military battle drills for those within the party, and we have a civilian form of training. There's a combatant system I created called Kaya Fakaya Kali Tuta Kinga, which in Kiswahili means Pan-African Defense System. The short name is Tuta Kinga. What this system deals with is it deals with combatants more like a special forces type dynamic where we do pistol, rifle, shotgun disarmament, but also accuracy training, close quarter combat with that. Our striking system is boxing. Our leg system is like a combination of like Muay Thai and
Okay, that's good.
African kickboxing. And we also have aspects of Brazilian jiu-jitsu in that as well. So we do combative training for indeed. But the point is that we're at war. And, the greatest wars that we're facing now is economic and also housing and food. So these are forms of war. It's not just social. Those are forms of warfare. And they're just as dangerous and murderous as bullets. So those are aspects of revolution as well.
Yeah, but see, they had the Black Power conferences in St. Louis in the 60s, 80s. My point is that even the former Panther Party developed alliances both with, their attorney was white, Charles Gary. They were socialists and things of this nature. They had Marlon Brando and Jane Fonda giving them money. What are y'all sources for support, financial support? The original Black Panther Party had a newspaper, was the second highest sold newspaper in the country in the 70s, next to the Nation, next to Muhammad Speak, but black newspaper. But so, how do y'all raise money?
We raise money collectively amongst ourselves. We don't have any grants from any government or anything like that. And I will say that there are some levels that we do have supporters. And it ain't no, let me just say this, it ain't no George Soros or nothing like that. And there's no nobody of that magnitude, but we have people who are committed, who are core revolutionaries, who help us as well. And most of it is out of pocket. So, in the 60s and the 70s, we were able to have that success. And we still stand on the party line. We are Black nationalists and Pan-Africans and also scientific socialists. That's African Center Marxist-Leninists. So we don't hold biases in the context that we would not accept, contributions from people who we can consider comrades that would happen to be white or anybody else. But the point is that, we currently, our funding is collective. We believe in what I was mentioning earlier, low-end collectivism and high-end collectivism. With that low-end collectivism, that is a service that we collectively do, feed, clothe, shelter, train, defend. Also can include monetary dynamics so that we can make self-sufficiency where we have enough resources to do for self. So we believe in doing for self.
That's good. Now, the original Panthers were based in Oakland. I know you got a chapter in Oakland. The sister was Sister Acacia Zaire. She's out there in Oakland. Where is y'all based at?
Well, the reason why we chose, I'll tell you where, the South is because of just how laws are today. You know, you can't be on the way you need to in California. But Jackson, Mississippi is actually where our national HQ is.
That's your headquarters.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So is the Black mayor, I forget. I doubt him.
Chukwuma Lumumba. You talking about Chukwuma Lumumba?
Yeah, is he working with you or what?
We communicate. I respect the mayor. We communicate with him, but it's actually Brother Kenny, who's a city councilman. They're close. Well, kind of got their little thing going now. We work with most of the black officials there. You know. I don't want to speak too much on what the mayor does and what he doesn't do because of politics, you know, with him. Mm-hmm. But I ain't going to talk bad about no Black mayor. But I will say this. There's a lot of us who aren't what our parents were. I'll just say that.
Okay. Oh, well, Chokwe was strong. I know that.
Absolutely. And that's I love, that elder, Chukwuma Lumumba. Mm-hmm. I can't say I wasn't around him enough to be considered a mentor. But the times that I was around him, he definitely had an impact on my life.
Okay. Well, any other questions anybody have?
One question. Sometimes, well, Brother Muhammad?
Yes.
Go
did
ahead.
You say that, how did you phrase it? You said that you were African-centered Marxist-Leninist.
Yes,
is that
sir.
What you said?
Yes.
Okay, I just need to be clear about that. Thank you.
Yes.
Linda?
I'm here, but I don't have any questions.
Go ahead,
Professor Rock. Kasha has her hand up.
Okay.
Hi. So, to Professor Ra and to the other panel, I have a question. Since we talked about revolutionary, I wanted to ask, is anybody involved in revolutionary actions? Do you have any connection to someone that if something happened to where you are, that they're ready to bear arms and, protest or make things, how am I trying to say, if there's any violence that is really strong going on, do you guys have anyone that is ready to take that stand? And also, do you have any, with the questions of connections of finances, do you have any allies that's ready to be a part and be financially ready to financially gift anybody of the Revolutionary Party, whether it be the Revolutionary Black Panther Parties or any other type of organization, since we talked about the people that were funding the Black Panthers, and I am here in Oakland. So I do get to hear a lot of dialogue. I've heard a lot of dialogue here, but I haven't really heard anyone saying, I know this person, I know that person, let's connect this person and that person to this organization or that organization to build them, to make them be strong, because I am here in Oakland and there is nothing going on with the original Black Panthers, be it Frederica or Torino, Huey Newton's nephew. So with question of speaking on old leadership, and with all the wisdom, is there anybody that's involved that's ready to help build something revolutionary or with people that are ready to jump in the trenches if something does happen or be financial donors to a farm?
Who are you asking that question to?
Everyone that can answer.
Anybody want to answer it before I say anything?
Well, what I could say is we developed this online platform of Community Education Network during the pandemic. We wanted to make a contribution to what has been previously done. And education is our base. We are, we come under the tutelage of Professor Amin Ra, and we affiliate with mostly educators. So that's our initial contribution to the movement for our key saying is we want to improve individually and collectively. So we're into improvement of the individual and our diaspora. So that we are initially starting, we're 4 years in, going on 5 years. And so we are affiliated with people like Professor Ra has people that he has mentored, I mean, thousands that are in leadership position. Like his son is an NAACP president. He in Oakland, brother Muhammad, the
wait, yeah, wait a minute.
Yeah, and so these are people that are directly influenced by what we have going on, and we're just beginning. So there's a lot to come from this organization. I can say that because I have a lot that I want to do. So that's basically what we're doing. We're connecting with you also, Akasha. We want to do things with you because you have shown interest, and brother Muhammad also. We would like to do some things. So that's really the contribution we have at this moment. So in finance, anything that's financed is financed through me, through this organization, which is, you know, my small budget. But that's what we have going. Professor Ron may have some other things going and other people outside of what we're doing here. So Professor Ron.
Yes. First of all, I appreciate the question, if I understand correctly. And thank you for the question, Acacia. I'm pretty sure your commander-in-chief, Dr. Ali Muhammad, know that them that know won't say and them that say don't know when it comes down to what people are doing as far as their preparation for defense. But some people just prepare, period. I mean, America's the biggest gun-buying country in the world, and they got black gun clubs all over the country and everything like that. But are there organizations? Yeah, there are plenty of organizations, but they don't come out and announce themselves. They don't say, I'm doing this. They're black veterans and black this and black that. They don't announce themselves because of COINTELPRO, counterintelligence programs, as well as collaborators, as well as infiltrators and agent provocateurs. And Brother Ali, if you battlefield tested, you know you don't announce that. Second, when it comes down to finances, you know, most people that are financing these type of things don't want to be known, and they ain't going to let nobody know that they're going to finance a revolution. They're not going to do that publicly or anything like that. That's why we have this program to introduce your organization, as Brother Roshki was saying. And so those that want to contact you and help you any way they can, or affiliate with your platform, they can, because this will be on YouTube, and we reach hundreds of people all the time. And so that's our contribution. But as far as discussing organizations that are individuals that would support a revolutionary movement with under this government, with publicly, is committing revolutionary suicide, you know, and you don't do that. You know, if you've been in the struggle at all, you know, you do not announce who supports you and who don't support you. And that's why Brother Ali Muhammad didn't mention people that they were being supported by. He said, we got donors. We got people within our own structure. And that's because he's trained and he's disciplined. So but that's my answer.
Okay, I understand. I was just trying to speak to you asking who was financially backing or if we had any financial backing, because what you said was truly profound in your answer, but it was kind of, just to me, a little contradictory, because you did ask the question and you spoke on Jane Fonda and other people that supported the Black
Panther. For the Black Panther, the original Black Panther Party.
No, but you asked Revolution, you asked, so you did.
I
you
asked
did.
Him, how do he raise money for the organization? Is he selling papers, or are they doing something like that? You know, to get it out there. So the people, if they wanted to help, how they raise money for the organization, not for the revolution, for his structure, for his programs.
Oh, I thought you asked, did he have anybody backing him for funding?
No, I never said
then
that.
Then you spoke to, okay, that's what I thought I heard you say. I could be mistaken, but I thought that's what you said.
Well, I asked him, how did they raise money? Because the original Black Panther Party had the second best-selling newspaper. They raised money through papers and donation. By
yeah, we've been hanging at Merritt College.
Yeah.
They're still there. Yeah.
All right, so Brother, Brother Ali, you have closing statement?
Yeah, Dean, what I wanted to say is, for anybody that wants to help or contribute towards our programs, like I mentioned, we have programs throughout the country. Again, 40 chapters nationwide. At 40 operational chapters, we have a plethora of programs. We have domestic violence prevention, couples classes, drug treatment, drug prevention, 7-day-a-week food programs. We even have housing programs. We have programs that we offer. If anybody wants to help or support, they can actually go to our website at www.therevolutionaryblackpantherparty.org. That is www.therevolutionaryblackpantherparty.org. And we have a section there where you can donate or contribute. You can contribute through Cash App as well at $RPPNationalHQ1. That is $RPPNationalHQ1. And your actual contribution support definitely goes a long way, especially with our efforts for human rights and as we deal with this injustice and dealing with the genocide that's being currently waged against our people. I do know that we're going to discuss the topic of the night. If slavery was abolished in 1865 while Black people still complaining, are we going to talk about that at all tonight, or we're going to save that for another time?
Well, if you would like to come back and we could do that, because matter of fact, I don't know what you're doing tomorrow. We had a guest and for tomorrow, and that guest wasn't able to make it, and then I got another guest, and then he had to also back out, and so we're going to do a Black community news forum. If you have time tomorrow at 6, you can come back and we can go over that, or we could do it another time.
I would let you know tomorrow at about let me see, at about noon your time, I could confirm.
But we will be there doing the Black Community News Forum. So, but yeah, please let me know, and then we can just slide you right on in, because I know we didn't cover the topic, but we did get a chance to, you know, go through the panel, and people got a chance to ask questions, which was good.
Yeah, no, it was a very healthy dynamic. You know, it was healthy. Just the fact that I know that when people see the title, they're gonna be like, well, damn, you know how our people are. Black people, we always, they didn't even talk about what they wrote, what they was talking about, what they got to do with it. So we got to probably adjust the title. But what I will say, I will be at Merritt College on the 25th of this month. That is a Tuesday the 25th. And I'll be covering the topic of the role of the revolutionary in face of bourgeoisie oppression. You know, and how to combat the oligarchy. And that's going to be on Tuesday, March the 25th, from 6 p.m. until 7:30 p.m. Pacific time. So again, that's at Merritt College. And the topic that I'm going to be dealing with is the role of the revolutionary in face of bourgeoisie oppression and how to combat the oligarchy. and that would be at Merritt College in Oakland on Tuesday, March 25th, 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. So anybody who is in the Oakland area, or anybody who is in proximity, you know. So I know that Long Beach in L.A. is about, I think, what, maybe four hours, 4 to 6 hours, I think. I'm not entirely sure the drive. But anybody who's in the area who's interested in coming, definitely come out. Anybody who is in Oakland, definitely, you know, make sure that, you know, if you're able to be there, to be there. But that's basically, you know, what will be taking place. And I'll be in Flint, Michigan this Friday, dealing with these pigs who killed this young brother. And like I said, I'll be handling business. I'm not going to say exactly what's going to take place until it takes place, but it's going to be some action that will be monumental, and it will be an example on how we all can deal with those issues. When the state refuses to do what they need to do, we have ways to do things. We just haven't exercised those ways. The same way what Malcolm talked about, international court and the world court and all that, with the world court and how, you know, I've initiated these tribunals, but there's also ways to deal with these people too. And we haven't exercised it or tried it, but this Friday it'll be a show and prove on how to deal with those issues.
And if anybody is in Oakland or know anyone in Oakland that wants a platform to further push and promote the education that we need on the diaspora or Pan-Africanism, then definitely have them reach out to me or Dr. Muhammad, and we definitely can set up a platform for them at no cost for the space for us to continue on our mission and our journey.
All right, Rashpita. Next Tuesday, I think we got either Dr. Rose Allen talking about the closing of the Department of Education and its effect on Black people, or either Dr. Bobby, not Dr. Bobby, Robert Johnson, who was a former Panther. He'll be on, either one of them would be the guest, talking about his new book and his youth education programs at Cal State Dominguez. All right, one of the two, I'll let you know tomorrow so we can post it. But this will be on YouTube, and hopefully you get a lot of hits and people will respond to you, my brother, Dr. Ali Muhammad.
Definitely appreciate you all. And as I said, about tomorrow, I'll let send a message out by 2 p.m. Pacific if I'm going to be able to be on tomorrow. But like I said, I'll be in Oakland on the 25th.
Okay, Mansour, is that how you pronounce your name?
Mansunu.
Mansunu. Tell us a little bit about you, brother.
Oh, well, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I still live in the state of Maryland, but not in Baltimore. I was invited to listen to your program tonight by my nephew, Brother Muko.
Okay.
And, you know, he often tells me that he's in spaces like this, and it's not often I get a chance to come in, but I'm glad I was here tonight to hear all of the information and knowledge that was given. I'm 71. I'm retired from working about 12 years now.
Okay.
And I've just been doing my study and during the course of my lifetime the best that I can. You know, my biggest probably influences is Dr. Cress Welsing, Dr. Ben, Dr. Clark, some of the older heads.
Yeah.
Who are still not with us. But I'm just a guy. I'm just a brother.
Yeah, Ivan Van Sertima, all of them. Ivan Van Sertima, all of them. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. I understand. You, those are historians. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
All right.
So I'm just, you know, I'm just a victim of racism, white supremacy, like the rest of us, doing the best I can.
Some know and, some don't. You're right, brother. All right. It's good to meet you, brother.
Thank you, man. Nice to meet y'all too.
And I hope you come back.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to tune in tomorrow. I'm gonna
All
try
right,
to tune in
then.
Tomorrow.
All right.
Right. So thanks everybody for coming this evening. And we're gonna take our pause. Each one teach one in Conscious Corner. Continue you guys the rest of the evening or day.